The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Hello, this is Maureen McDonald for the North Carolina Reading Service. For the next half hour, I will be reading to you from the September 2022 Walter Magazine. We begin with A Stitch in Time. Precious Lovell reframes fabric art with her provocative pieces, by Colony Little. Clothing is one of our most intimate relationships, says Precious Lovell. Every day we get up and we put on something to present ourselves to the world. Whether it's a little black dress or a well-worn baseball cap, Lovell believes clothing speaks volumes about who we are and how we want to be perceived, and that it can be a powerful tool for storytelling through art. Fashion and art are close bedfellows for Lovell. She spent 20 years in the fashion industry, then another 2 decades teaching fashion, fiber, and surface design. Now in her 60s, she's a full-time visual artist, using her knowledge and expertise in textile and clothing design to create thought-provoking sculptures and installations from found garments and original weavings. As a child in Pilot Mountain, clothing and its fabrication was an ever-present influence on her. I come from a family of women who stitched, whether it was quilts or clothing, she says. Lovell studied fashion design at Virginia Commonwealth University and later relocated to New York City for a career in the garment industry, specializing in children's clothing design for Health Tech and Oshkosh. As a pattern maker, designer, and fashion forecaster, Lovell traveled extensively, visiting 45 countries. No matter where I go on Earth, there's one thing I see. Everybody is trying to strive for a better life, and especially a better life for their children. She moved to Qatar in 2001 to teach fashion design at VCU Arts Qatar, a school established between the VCU School of the Arts and the Qatar Foundation, a nonprofit that fosters university-level scholastic study in Doha, particularly for young women. After 6.5 years teaching, she decided to pursue more schooling in fibers and surface design to augment her teaching experience. Lovell returned to the United States and earned her master's in art and design at North Carolina State University and continued to teach at the Oregon College of Art and Craft, Kim Young University in South Korea, and NC State University. But even as she taught, Lovell pursued her own projects in visual art, using clothing and textiles as tools of communication and storytelling. Her works begin with clothing designs that are often embellished with text and symbolic imagery that convey messages of hope, history, memory, resistance, and resilience. In one powerful piece called Time's Effing Up, Lovell recreates the teal suit that Anita Hill wore during Clarence Thomas's confirmation hearings for the U.S. Supreme Court in 1991. The suit contains embroidered text and black award ribbons with phrases that draw parallels between that era, the Me Too movement, and the 2018 testimonies of Christine Blasey Ford against Brett Kavanaugh during his own confirmation hearings. On the front of the suit, Lovell places a large red A, the scarlet letter that calls to task discrimination, humiliation, and violence towards women nearly 200 years ago. The suit connects the past to the present, demanding that the viewer acknowledge patterns that keep repeating themselves. In October 2021, Lovell was named the inaugural Artist-in-Residence for Anchorlight Studios' Bright Work Fellowship. Artists need time, space, and money, says Shelley Smith, founder of Anchorlight, who notes that the purpose of the fellowship is to make North Carolina artists know that they are, quote, valued and validated in their practice, that they don't need to leave the state they call home for the sake of opportunity, and that opportunities of this nature will one day cease to be few and far between, end quote. Lovell's ability to balance storytelling with her technical expertise made the artist a natural choice for the Anchorlight Fellowship. Her depth of research, quality of craftsmanship, and attention to every detail of her practice is beyond reproach, says Smith. Her commitment to shining an unflinching light on American history while also creating objects of careful beauty and consideration results in work that holds powerful space, speaking to both our past and present, asking us not to look away. While previous solo exhibitions showcased distinct design practices that she aligned with specific narratives, Lovell's work for her Anchorlight show will include a broad range of techniques, including quilting, embroidery, crochet, and clothing design, which will each contain both coded and overt messages about inequality and the legacy of slavery. While she won't divulge the themes ahead of time, Lovell promises to pull no punches, putting on a show that will require slow and purposeful looking, while also creating a safe space for healing and growth. Anchorlight's selection of Lovell also affirms how important it is to support artists at all stages of their career, no matter when they choose to embark on their journey. I'm black, I'm female, and I'm over 60. Those are not things that are often celebrated in America's art world, or the art world in general, she says. I feel like this is a great opportunity for me. I'm a North Carolinian. I'm a native daughter. I feel like if I can't talk about North Carolina, who can? This article was edited for Time. From Music Department, handing over the keys. Through charitable initiative Keys for Kids, Ben Folds is creating opportunity for aspiring musicians, by David Menconi. Most rock musicians of my era would be doing a great service to admit where they got help along the way, Ben Folds says. I was lucky with the music teachers I had. They were great at encouragement, validation, and teaching the right thing at the right time. It's for that reason that Folds, a platinum-level pop star, started a charitable initiative called Keys for Kids this past May, using his fame to raise funds in support of arts education programs across North Carolina that provide instruments and lessons to young students who need them. Folds has charted a highly unconventional course since his late 1990s peak, when Ben Folds Five were Chapel Hill's biggest hitmakers. Since then, Folds has performed and recorded with everything from symphony orchestras to a cappella vocal groups, and even served as a celebrity judge on NBC's The Sing-Off contest show. Folds thinks enough of teachers that he dedicated a chapter of his best-selling 2019 memoir, A Dream About Lightning Bugs, A Life of Music and Cheap Lessons, to remembering the best ones he had growing up in Winston-Salem. Of particular note was the legendary John Chick Shelton at Wiley Magnet Middle School, not to be confused with Raleigh's Wiley Elementary School. Shelton taught generations of Winston's finest aspiring musicians over the years, including Folds and members of bands like the DBs and Let's Active, and now the middle school's band room is named after him. After high school, Folds went on to the University of Miami's Frost School of Music on a drums percussion scholarship, where he encountered a harder-edged class of teacher. After seeing the 2014 film Whiplash, for which actor J.K. Simmons won an Oscar for his performance as a hot-headed jazz drumming teacher, Folds even made inquiries to see if the character was based on one of his old Miami professors. The reply, no, but a few people have asked that about him. College was a high-pressure environment that ended with Folds throwing his drum kit in a lake after he had to perform his final with a broken hand. He flunked out. It was not the most positive experience, but I wouldn't trade it either, Fold says of his brief college career. They would turn students against each other, try to make you so uncomfortable that you'd push beyond what you'd normally do. In retrospect, I'm glad I got some scars to toughen me up. Within a few years, Folds was back in North Carolina, playing in bands, eventually landing in Chapel Hill with the piano pop trio Ben Folds Five. They caught on fast and had a hit single with Brick, plus a million-selling album with 1997's Whatever and Ever Amen. Folds is still keeping busy with current projects, including a recurring role on the TV drama series The Wilds, in which he plays himself in hallucination form, and working on his first new album since 2015. But arts advocacy, especially Keys for Kids, is taking up a lot of his bandwidth. On July 11, Folds played a live stream concert from Osceola Recording Studio in Raleigh, raising money in partnership with the North Carolina Arts Council and the North Carolina Arts Foundation. They, in turn, will distribute the money to local nonprofits that offer both instruments and instruction of piano and keyboard to students who can't afford them. It's fantastic to have a musician with his track record and visibility wanting to help students, says Wayne Martin, interim director of the North Carolina Arts Foundation, a Keys for Kids co-sponsor. I don't know of anybody else at his level doing anything like this. Ben really remembers the teachers and mentors who inspired him, and he's a deep thinker who wants to make the world a better place. I feel privileged to be his partner in this. For Folds, it's less about creating future rock stars than the challenge, practice, and joy of learning an instrument. I'm not trying to get kids to become musicians necessarily, Folds says, but the discipline of learning to play music makes them better scientists, communicators, parents. The earlier you get kids playing music, the better it is. This article was edited for Time. Next, from the vault, Anchored in Stone, a new acquisition at the North Carolina Museum of Art, offers a fresh perspective by Hampton Williams Hoffer. In 1866, the American artist Edmonia Lewis moved to Rome. There, among a vibrant community of artists, she worked in marble, sculpting busts of presidents and poets, queens and freedmen. Unlike her peers, most of whom sent their clay and plaster models off to Italian marble carvers to be cast into stone, Lewis did the work herself. She chiseled by hand, a tedious process undertaken both for lack of funding and for prevention of fraud. One of her few surviving works is a 21-inch marble sculpture called The Old Indian Arrow Maker and His Daughter. It's a new acquisition at the NCMA, monumental not in size, but in the narrative that surrounds it. Edmonia Lewis was remarkable, overcoming so many seemingly insurmountable obstacles in her life says Lauren Applebaum, the NCMA's curator of American art. The sculptor worked in a male-dominated world and was a person of Black and Native American descent in a country where slavery was still legal and indigenous peoples were derided. The daughter of a Chippewa mother who wove indigenous souvenirs for a living and a Haitian father who worked as a gentleman's servant, Lewis could not afford formal artistic training. She was orphaned at a young age and grew up with her maternal aunts in upstate New York. When her brother hit it big in the California Gold Rush, he sent her to receive a proper education at Oberlin College in Ohio, one of the first higher learning institutions in the country to accept women of color. Then she moved to Boston to pursue a career as a sculptor, fashioning her own tools to make plaster medallions of famous abolitionists. She held her first solo exhibition in 1864, garnering attention with a bust of Colonel Robert Shaw, a Union officer who led the first all-black regiment in the Northeast during the Civil War. She made enough money from sales of copies of the bust that she was able to travel to Europe, eventually settling in Rome in 1866, a place that offered creative opportunities unavailable at home to a woman of color. It was there that Lewis created the old Indian arrow maker and his daughter, inspired by arguably the most popular piece of literature of her time, Henry Wadsworth Longfellow's 1855 poem, Song of Hiawatha. "This sculpture had been on my radar," Applebaum says, "and I knew it was important for us to acquire it." While countless artists across all genres in the late 19th century drew inspiration from Longfellow's poem, Lewis's portrayal is different. The epic poem follows the legendary Ojibwe warrior Hiawatha and his love for a Dakota woman named Minnehaha in a fictional tragedy. There's a moment in the story when the suitor, Hiawatha, approaches Minnehaha and her father. At the doorway of his wigwam sat the ancient arrow maker. At his side, in all her beauty, sat the lovely Minnehaha. This is the moment of Lewis's focus. In her sculpture, the arrow maker and Minnehaha, both with their hands at work, look outward as Hiawatha comes to greet them, the deer at their feet a symbol of courtship. A prominent way of viewing indigenous people at this time was as a vanishing race, Applebaum says. But Lewis is showing an intergenerational scene of a father and daughter, the daughter working on a traditional craft practice while father makes an arrowhead. It speaks to perpetuation. Valerie Hillings, the director of the NCMA, was intrigued by Applebaum's passion for adding a Lewis piece to the museum's collection. "I was particularly thinking, as a director, how does this artist connect to what's here or change what's here?" Hillings says. As it turns out, Lewis fits right in. The museum's grand portrait gallery boasts Saul under the influence of the evil spirit, another marble sculpture carved by William Wetmore Story, an American living in Italy in the 1860s. There's also Daphne, a marble bust of the Greek tree spirit by another American sculptor, Harriet Hosmer. Hosmer was also in Italy at the time and one of few well-known women sculptors of her era. She became a friend and mentor to Lewis. While Lewis never achieved the commercial success of the other two, it's fitting that her work sits alongside that of her contemporaries more than a century later. The addition of Lewis's The Old Indian Arrow Maker and His Daughter offers an alternate interpretation, a parallel narrative. It's the same medium, marble, from the same era, but a sympathetic, proud depiction of Native Americans by a woman of indigenous descent. It's the same literary muse, but a different focal point, one that turns a lens on family and tradition at a time when many were depicting Native Americans as savages. And this is exactly the point of adding this piece, at a time when the museum is rethinking the people's collection with an eye towards inclusivity and broadening the narrative. Lewis is what Hillings calls an anchor artist, one who roots an exhibition. And in this case, the anchor artist will help to tell the story of American art in a wider way, a fresher way. What is rich about this work is that it has all this narrative about someone who was in a circle of artists working abroad, creating an incredible sculpture, Hillings says, and also that there's a woman in the portrait, that it's a representation of a woman by a woman. It tells so many stories. This article was edited for Time. And from the Nature Department, Bear Country, Remarkable Encounters Inside Our Coastal Plain Wildlife Refuges, by Mike Dunn. I remember seeing my first bear when I was a kid. My parents took me to Great Smoky Mountains National Park, and a bear ran across the road in front of our car. I was so excited, a bear in the wild. That sighting inspired me to learn more about these charismatic mammals. For the next couple of decades, I saw only the occasional bear, usually while vacationing in the mountains. Then I started working for the North Carolina State Park System in 1981. A ranger at Pettigrew State Park suggested I visit the nearby Pungo National Wildlife Refuge, or NWR, on my next vacation to see wintering waterfowl. On my first trip to the refuge, my friend and I walked down a gated gravel road to the sounds of tundra swans and snow geese on Pungo Lake, just beyond a tract of forest that bordered the road. We took a side trail that went out to the lake. My friend stopped to look at some tracks while I continued down the path to the water. As I approached, I saw the top of a sapling shaking back and forth. I eased around to see what was causing it and was amazed to see a black bear scratching her back by rubbing against the trunk of the tree. There was a young bear next to her, probably a year-old cub, judging by its size. I took a few photos and waited for my friend. By the time he got there, the bears had walked off into the brush. When I told him what he'd missed, he replied that I'd missed something too, a bobcat sitting near where he entered the woods. What an incredible place! That visit started what has been a 40-year love affair with the public lands of our state's wild and wonderful coastal plain. Since then, I've traveled to this refuge, now called Pocosin Lakes NWR, and nearby Matamuskete and Alligator River NWRs hundreds of times in all seasons. The Pungo area has one of the highest densities of black bears, the only species of bear in the eastern U.S., in North America. The total number of bears in eastern North Carolina is believed to be around 10,000, compared to an estimated mountain population of about 6,000 bears. The world record black bear was found in Craven County and weighed 880 pounds. Their large size and my winter sightings are due to the mild climate and ready availability of food year-round. These bears typically don't hibernate long, if at all, and continue feeding through much of the winter. On a hot August afternoon a few years ago, we came across a huge male sitting in the water of one of the roadside canals at Alligator River NWR. He just sat there, soaking it all in, eyes half shut, like you or I might do on a sultry summer day. Eventually, he opened his eyes, climbed the steep bank, and ambled across the field to get a snack. One day, as I drove down a dusty refuge road, I passed a single tree by a roadside canal. To my surprise, there was a bear lounging on a limb, just barely out of sight of the several cars that had already driven by. I stopped, poked the camera out the window, and took a few photos. The bear started chewing on the tree, and I realized it was making a more comfortable spot to lie on the big limb by getting rid of a branch poking its side. After a few minutes, the annoying branch was gone, and the bear fell asleep. I always enjoy seeing cubs. They're so playful and cute. This summer I happened upon a mother bear with three cubs hanging out on a huge dirt pile at the edge of a field. One cub was pawing at the tolerant mother bear, while the other two were having a wrestling match in the dirt, just like kids in a sandbox. I sat down to watch and photograph them for several minutes before they climbed down off the dirt playground and headed off into the woods. As usual, I used a telephoto lens and kept my distance so as not to influence their behavior. Though they will generally run from people, bears are wild animals that should be treated with respect. Want to see bears in the wild? Head down to either Pocosin Lakes, NWR, or Alligator River, NWR, especially early or late in the day, and cruise the roads. Keep an eye on the fields or down the road in front of you, and don't forget to look up in the trees as well. Alligator River also offers tram tours for viewing wildlife, including bears, throughout the summer and fall. This article was edited for Time. Lastly, check out the IBMA World of Bluegrass, September 27th through October 1st in Raleigh. In addition to the bevy of bluegrass, the street festival will include food trucks, North Carolina brews, and an art and craft market powered by Artsplosure and Black Friday markets. It's free for general admission. We've run out of time for today's episode of Walter Magazine. Be sure to tune in next time. We hope you've enjoyed it. I'm Maureen McDonald for the North Carolina Reading Service. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Walter Magazine's available as a podcast at our website, ncreadingservice.org. If you have any comments or questions, call us at 919-832-5138. That number again is 919-832-5138. And thank you for listening to the North Carolina Reading Service.